is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something, and we are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking with Fraser Nyman, Director of Archaeology at Jefferson's Monticello. We'll talk about the digital archaeological archive that he was instrumental in creating, an intricate online catalog and resource which looks at slave lives here in Virginia and across the Atlantic, and also tries to understand Jefferson's Monticello plantation in its larger historical context. Also, he's involved with many other projects, a huge excavation going on there at Monticello, and we'll also discuss Sally Hemings' living quarters unearthed just this year. We'll talk about that discovery and why it's so important. We also have with us Karen McGlathery, director of the new Environmental Resilience Institute at the University of Virginia. She's a professor and environmental scientist tackling some of our planet's biggest problems. As we've seen, so many people living near water are increasingly vulnerable to violent storms. So we'll discuss her work and what's being done to help us thrive despite the apparent crisis. You can check out all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org. And now, my lovely co-host, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here, and I have to say, I know I start a few shows this way, but I'm going to say it this way. One day, very soon, I need to be a guest on our show because I want to hear your introduction for me. I mean, they are so good. They're always, and I mean it, they are so good, and I just wonder, how would Ellen introduce me should I be a guest? So I'm coming on. I'm coming on as a guest. That's all
right.
Do it.
Well, I would love to introduce you. In fact, let me tell you a little bit about Nancy Lawrence.
No. Exactly. Yeah. And that says Al Franken from the 70s, as I'll get. But anyway,
thanks again
you for those great introductions for our guests. They are.
Well, it's because of them. They produce their own introductions by doing the great work that they do, I must say. But thank you.
So you know what? I rescind my offer because it's true. It is based on the people sitting in the seats, and that would definitely affect your write-up of me. Anyway.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about
the fact that we don't have to talk about Graham Cassidy?
Let's not
talk about that, because it'll come back with two other senators' names next month. Or no, I think in January is when they've scared us.
Yeah, that was for the defeat of Obamacare.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't know. I know it has. I know this is not my joke, but it has the bill itself apparently has a great health policy of an Obamacare policy because it just refuses, you know, it just cannot die. Does anyone think it's dead? Do you?
No. But I do want to talk about the NFL a little bit. And I have this great acronym, not the effing flag is really what NFL should stand for, but it doesn't quite work. But Dale Earnhardt, some people you would think, you know, he's NASCAR driver, of course, people you'd think would be conservative, came out against this Cittadini. He said, all Americans are granted rights to peaceful protests. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable, quoting JFK. And my favorite, and then I'll let you come in edgewise, Tom Costas, I think he really nailed it. It's what I've been really feeling and not being able to put into words. He said, patriotism has been associated with the military only, and patriotism comes in many forms. And what has happened is that it's been conflated with a bumper style sticker, kind of flag waving, and with military only. And he said, school teachers and social workers are patriots. Martin Luther King was a patriot. Susan B. Anthony was a patriot.
Yes. It's amazing. I actually learned... I will not try and top Tom Costas. I actually learned that the idea of the players coming out on the field only started in 2009. I know they've been playing the anthem for longer, but just this whole idea that it's this historical thing that they are disrespecting on top of the irony of the man who's, you know, using this latest, you know, divisive wedge, you know, as you know, I mean, disrespects Gold Star families, has called the country a disaster. The White House is a dump. You know, has more respect, I think, for the Confederate flag. It's just, you know, just you just want to pull your hair out about it. And the fact that when it's a private protest, you know, they can't do it in the street. They can't do it, you know, quietly. They just can't do it. You know, there's never a good time. I just shake my head about the whole thing.
Right, to shift to Wanda Sykes. I'm not on the microphone.
Oh, there you are. Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, can you go on the fridge and get me a soda while you're up?
Yeah, I was doing something for our guests over here, helping things out, helping the program work. So Wanda Sykes, just to go into Puerto Rico just for a minute, Wanda Sykes said if players were taking a knee in Puerto Rico, maybe Trump would have noticed Puerto Rico.
I can't wait for the silver lining of all this when, because it surely seems like people in, once just as they did with Katrina, you know, a majority of those people are going to have to come to the mainland to survive, to live. You know, it's going to take like 6 months to get power. And anyway, and I can't wait if all of them can come here and to the mainland, and then they get the right to vote. You know, is this, you know, like the last laugh on the way they're being treated? It's unbelievable. I'm sure he did just realize that they're citizens.
Yeah. So just moving along, I heard some NFL players talking about saying this is, and many others, that this country was born out of protest and that these issues are making people uncomfortable. So people want to make it about something else. It's really not about the military. It's not about the flag. And Trump's strategy, as always, using the authoritarian playbook, is to malign, divide, deflect, conquer, and then repeat.
Yeah,
that's right. And some things that we can do here and all over. I just found out about ACLU is launching People Power, Let People Vote. It's going to be an online streaming in all 50 states, and there's something locally here at Seville at the Sojourners at 7 p.m. It's a live stream training to help people understand what they can do, a grassroots movement to protect, expand voting rights across America. And the website is peoplepower.org. I'm very fascinated by that. So I'm glad that we're organizing on a national level about that. You can also register to vote online, vote.elections.virginia.gov. And you should do that by November or October 16th here in Virginia. And the election is November 7th here in Virginia once again. And there's just tons going on about that. Just look up Indivisible, Google some things, and you'll find what you need to know.
Yeah, you're one of those states where every district or every district is up for a vote. I believe you're, because I remember mentioning this a couple of weeks ago, right? Isn't that the case for you guys?
And can you talk for a minute? Hold the mic for me, okay?
Okay, I can talk for a minute. Here, actually, speaking of things that are disconcerting, that this whole the Russia thing, which of course should be the five alarm fire, has somehow become, you know, it's out there. But anyway, just this, you know, the latest revelations that Facebook and Twitter actually were more instrumental. Everything was more instrumental than we've been led to believe. The shoes are already falling, but you know, as they get louder, I'll stop with the metaphor, but just learning how much more was going on social media. I swear, you know, it's like you could see this Russian interference from space. I mean, it's just so pervasive.
Yeah.
And
do you remember the guy on All in the Family? What's it, Rob Reiner? Okay, Rob Reiner started a website. I do not have it with me, but it's something like investigaterussia.org, something like that. And it's everything you want to know about the investigation, all the facts. And I would advise people to go there. I'm going to go there after the show. And
okay.
Then let's continue.
Well, just don't go during
the
show.
Thanks for
joining.
I know. I was gone for a minute. I have to say, technical difficulties that we figured out. Way to go. Our first guest is Fraser Nyman, Director of Archaeology at Jefferson's Monticello. He was instrumental in creating a digital archaeological archive of comparative slavery, which looks at slaves' lives in Virginia, the Carolinas, the Caribbean. And tries to understand Jefferson's Monticello plantation in its larger historical and spatial context. He is involved with the Mountaintop Project excavation, a very huge excavation. We'll talk about that. And we're going to discuss Sally Hemings' living quarters on Earth just this year. She was, of course, a slave with whom Jefferson fathered at least six children. Welcome to the show, Fraser.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Good. Is everything working over there? Can we hear? Yes.
I think so.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where to start. I think I'm going to start with the digital archive. Can you? I looked at it. It's an amazing archive. It's an amazing website. Can you talk about that? It's got hundreds of excavated sites here in Virginia. Can you talk a little bit about what that project is?
Sure. Absolutely. When I first came to Monticello, one of our big challenges was to get some kind of analytical control over literally hundreds of thousands of artifacts that had been previously excavated there. And to do that, we needed to get them digitized. And this is a problem that archaeologists always confront, is how to turn their bones and stones into usable, useful data that can be analyzed. One of the challenges we have traditionally faced is that we all have slightly different ways of doing it, which means that when we bang one set of data from one site dug by one person up against another set of data dug by another archaeologist at another site, they often don't fit together nicely. So our challenge was to try to invent a set of data structures and analytical protocols that would help folks essentially get on the same page and be able to do apples-to-apples comparisons. And the motivation behind that was that we might be able to see sort of longer-term trends, right, that transcend the occupation period for a single site, and we'd also be able to understand better large-scale spatial variation to see how, for example, a sugar plantation on Nevis in the Eastern Caribbean differed, life for enslaved people there differed from, say, lives for people at Monticello growing tobacco.
And in terms of, the cross-referencing around the world or whoever else is posting information about this, what have you found that is common between, like, the Sally Hemings project and, as I said, other archival data that's being posted?
There's a lot of variation, and it's very interesting. You know, archaeologists have wondered, you know, what causes, say, regional variation in the kinds of artifacts that we find on sites occupied by enslaved folks, say in the Caribbean versus Virginia. And the sort of possible large-scale causes are, you know, where in Africa enslaved people are coming from. Another one is the European origins of slave owners and the nation-state under which they're governed. A third is the kind of crop and the sort of labor regimes and organizational strategies that labor owners employ in response to their niche in the larger Atlantic economy. If I had to sort of peg one or pick one of those that emerges from our work as most critical, it's labor regimes and the niche in the Atlantic economy. That the reason sugar plantations, say on Nevis, look the way they do is not because Africans came from a given place in Africa, but rather because people are growing sugar.
And what got you started on the Sally Hemings project specifically, and what's involved in an undertaking of that size?
Right. Well, the Mountaintop Project is really the overarching name of this enterprise. Began really 4 years ago with a gift from David Rubenstein, hedge fund owner out of D.C. And this was really a kind of gave us the resources to put back on the mountaintop a lot of the missing critical bits of the landscape that Jefferson and the Hemings family knew at Monticello. One of the major obstacles in our kind of previous restoration work were decisions made by our predecessors at Monticello, extending into the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And among those was where to put bathrooms. So we have actually, in the 40s, the foundation installed a set of bathrooms in the south wing, one of the two wings that are connected to the second Monticello. And those have really prevented us from interpreting not only the original kitchen that Jefferson constructed in 1770, but also two rooms, one of which we are pretty sure, based on documentary sources, was where Sally Hemings lived after 1809 when the South Wing was completed.
So can you talk more about the significance of that? And it was not noticed for decades, right? I mean, you just found it.
The idea that we've discovered it is a bit misleading. We have long known the attribution of her residence there comes from a 1850 letter in which one of Jefferson's biographers writes that he stood in the ruins of the South Wing with Thomas Jefferson Randolph, Jefferson's grandson, and TJR says this is where Sally Hemings lived. So we don't know exactly which room it is, but it's one of two domestic spaces in the South Wing that are right next to each other. So once we sort of ripped out the modern accoutrements, tile floors and walls and ceilings, we were able to kind of get back and see what was actually physically left. We managed to find, the remains, just the trace of the remains of the original brick floor, some plaster. So the room was finished with plaster, which was, sort of a higher standard of finish at the time. And we also found some remains of where shelving had been kind of cut into the chimney face. But in terms of artifacts, people don't throw artifacts away in their living space itself. So there was really very little, in terms of portable artifacts in the area that we were able to excavate. Most of the trash that originated in these rooms lies in the kitchen yard out in front, where it's mixed up with stuff from Jefferson's kitchen and a whole array of other material from Mulberry Row, the street of slave buildings adjacent to the mansion.
I mean, to you as an archaeologist, does it bring this person that has been really controversial, or the whole Jefferson is extremely controversial, even more so these days, does it bring her to life? What does it mean to you?
Well, I think the hope is that it will allow us, Monticello, to interpret Sally Hemings as a person, right? To try to help visitors engage with her existence. She, clearly was for an enslaved person, led a really unique and, I think, provocative kind of existence. I mean, who else, just think of the number of even free Virginians who lived in Paris for 2 years. I think, trying to understand or recognize and think about her aspects of her individuality is a major goal of our interpretive efforts in this space.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Fraser Nyman, director of archaeology at Jefferson's Monticello. We'll be back after this break. We're going to be talking with Karen McGlathery, environmental scientist. Stick with us. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We're here with Fraser Nyman. We're talking about archaeology at Monticello. We've talked about some really cool things during the break. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. You mentioned France, and I wasn't sure what you meant by that. And then we were talking about a stove that's of significance.
Yes, absolutely. So, yes, Sally Hemings spent 2 years in France, in Paris, with Jefferson. But she shows up actually 2 years into his stay there when he's ambassador for the New Republic to France. When he initially left and was appointed ambassador, he took with him to France James Hemings, who was one of Sally's brothers. And his idea was that James would be trained in French cuisine as a French chef. Jefferson encountered, we think, French cuisine when he was a student at William & Mary and was a frequent guest at the governor's palace, and he clearly thought this was pretty cool. But in order to produce this stuff, you needed to have somebody who was trained in the art of French cooking, which had really evolved in the late 17th and 18th centuries in France. So he took James Hemings with him. Hemings studied cooking for 4 years, became fluent in French, and when Jefferson came back in order to kind of reap the benefits of Hemings' new expertise, he had constructed in the original kitchen at Monticello what's called a stew stove. This is essentially an 18th century cooktop fired with charcoal that you'd pull out of a open hearth fireplace. But in order to do the sauces and fricassees, etc., that is comprised French cuisine, you couldn't do that over an open hearth. So you had to have one of these special stoves. Remarkably, we've, in part of this pulling modern stuff out of the South dependency that I mentioned earlier, we were able to yank up, again, modern tile floors and then excavate 3 feet of fill that had been deposited in the original kitchen by Jefferson in 1809, roughly, and discover on the original kitchen floor a stew stove that, by looking at stratification and also the kinds of artifacts that came out of those layers, we were able to date sort of post 1780. So it's pretty clear that this is, in fact, the stew stove that Jefferson has built for Hemings when he comes back from France.
Wow.
So it's a cool thing. I mean, it's very seldom that we actually find a constructed artifact like this that we can associate with an individual enslaved African American. So that's going to be an important part of our new exhibit in the South Wing next year.
That's unbelievable that you're walking. I can't remember. Well, you will shortly tell me. I can't remember how long you've been in charge of the grounds, but that people have been walking over this, obviously, for years and years and years, and lo and behold, look what you've been walking on. Which is, I was wondering, what is it like to visit? How much of the grounds are being excavated, and what does that look like? The work you're doing.
For the Mountaintop Project, we're very much in the public eye because it's on the mountaintop. It's right next to the mansion. But much of our work and our research, our major research focus, is the larger landscape outside the mountaintop. The mountaintop is really just the tip of the iceberg, and the real, what I like to think of as the sort of real historical and ecological Monticello, the plantation was originally a 5,000 acre tract of land that is now, I suppose, partially submerged beneath the threshold of historical visibility, and also covered with forest, much of which has grown up since. So, we have a long-term research project called the Monticello Archaeological Plantation Survey, which is an attempt to not only find all the archaeological sites on the 2,500 acres of land that we own, but also document and understand changing settlement patterns and agricultural land use as Europeans and enslaved Africans initially show up in the area in the early 18th century. As the economy changes in the late 18th century and tobacco production gives way to wheat production, and then the decline of agriculture in Virginia in the mid mid-19th century, as Virginia farmers find themselves unable to compete with grain from the Midwest, which is now readily available on Atlantic markets thanks to the opening of the Erie Canal.
You know, speaking of architectural history, what drew you to it, and what can be gained by studying it?
Well, you know, I think that the challenge of archaeology is, you know, it kind of goes back to, you know, what I said at the beginning. You know, it's, you know, how do you figure out historical dynamics, what happened in the past, from objects? And that's a great intellectual puzzle. Archaeologists violently disagree about how this is best done. But from my perspective, I mean, what we've continually found useful is the idea that artifacts are the, what I like to call, the hard parts of the strategies that people used in the past to make their lives better, to make the lives of their families better, and to make the lives of the groups to which they belong better. And so our job as archaeologists is to carefully excavate and measure those artifacts in record their original context of deposition, and then from their patterning in space and time, try to evaluate hypotheses about how the artifacts figured in these larger strategies that people use and that shape long-term historical trajectories of the societies to which they belong.
So are you involving at all African-Americans right now in the decision-making, in the process? Is that something that's possible?
Yes, actually, yes. Yeah. So Monticello, for since actually the early 90s, has had a project, oral history project, called Getting Word, which has actually been a very successful attempt to trace descendants of people enslaved at Monticello and collect from them oral histories of their family histories. Not only, I think the original intent was that perhaps family histories might give us evidence of what life was like at Monticello under slavery. In fact, what Getting Word has really turned up is an amazing story of family resilience during the 19th and late 19th and 20th centuries under Jim Crow. So we're in regular contact with those folks. We have two African-American staff members who are dedicated as liaisons with that group, and as well as their other duties. So yes, and are actually the interpretive plans for, say, Sally Hemings' room. One of the two domestic spaces that I talked about. We will interpret as Sally Hemings' room. The other one, however, will be devoted to the Getting Word project. And descendants are, you know, we're currently consulting with them about what those exhibits are going to look like. So
that's great to hear. Is Getting Word something that if you Googled you would find?
Yes,
some
you
stuff
absolutely.
About?
Yep,
okay,
yep.
Cool.
So it's just Getting Word Monticello. There's a website devoted to it.
It's great.
Great stuff.
Good. Fraser Nyman, thank you so much for being here. Director of Archaeology at Monticello. You can go to the Digital Archaeological website. I believe it's daacs.org and the Monticello website and find out a lot more.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, Nance, how you doing?
Well, the more things change, the more things stay the same.
What do you mean?
Well, I was thinking of the NFL. I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, just the idea of having a voice and history. The news of note that I bring to you today is actually from the people that are managing Hurricane Maria's efforts. This is an under the radar-ish piece of news. That prospective U.S. immigrants will be required to turn over their social media handles and profile information to the Department of Homeland Security per new policy outlined by them. The new rule was quietly published in the Federal Register, last week, and grants the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services the ability to access social media handles, their aliases, any aliases, associated identifiable information, and any search results of any and all immigrants, including both permanent residents and naturalized citizens. So, like, you know, privacy concerns aside, it's just another alarm of how they're not only invading privacy, but it's very nonspecific what sort of access they're going to have and what they're going to do with it. But it does take effect October 18th. So, you know, some more chaos, as we were speaking about earlier, into everyone's lives, just changing the laws without really thinking about what they're going to do.
Right. So to that, I would say vote. I would say, you know, like I say every show, no one has to do everything, but everyone needs to do something. So it's fantastic that people are listening to the show, that I'm sure that everyone listening is doing something. But we need to vote, and we need to talk to our family members, that, you know, those uncomfortable conversations, I really think that is, those are the building blocks of how we can affect change. And the TikTok of the Mueller investigation could not be any more, you know, on my mind all the time, and I wish the thing would already, like, happen. But until then, you know, we're really, democracy is really being tested, is what I have to say. And there's a candidate forum here in Charlottesville. I mean, there's so much stuff going on, so many ways to plug in. It doesn't have to be calling people, you know, it could, just in a nutshell, it doesn't have to be something that you feel guilty that you're not doing. There is something for everyone to do, even if it's just a conversation with someone. And, you know, Priscilla Mendenhall was on last week. She is a great organization. You can just Google her name and contact her about what to do about immigrants, helping, not immigrants, but undocumented people here, and what they, I guess they are immigrants sometimes. What can be done to help them?
DACA is still out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, oh my God.
Yes.
Sorry.
Anyway,
yes.
So back to the environment. I wanted to introduce our next guest.
Okay.
May I do that?
Yeah.
I'm just playing with dials, you know, buying time over here.
Well, that reminds me of dials. No, go ahead. I'm sure you figured it out.
Remember the day when I had someone running this board for me? Anyway, so I'm happy to do it. And I'm happy to have Karen McGlathery here. She's the director of the New Environmental Resilience Institute at the University of Virginia. She's a professor and environmental scientist tackling some of our planet's biggest problems. And we'll discuss her work in just a moment and what's being done, as I said before, to help us thrive despite this apparent crisis. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Hey.
So where would you like to start listening to all this? I'm gonna put it all on you. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, maybe what I'll start, you mentioned Hurricane Maria. I think we've all become very aware of the vulnerability of people along the coastline to hurricanes and also sea level rise. First we had Harvey, then we had Irma, then we had Maria. And it really, when you think about it, half the world's population lives within 100 miles of the coast. Half the world's population, and even more depend on coastal resources. And so these people are, both people and infrastructure, property, are at great risk to climate change. And so our work focuses a lot on that. I'm particularly, my research focuses on the role of healthy coastal ecosystems and being the first line of defense to sea level rise and storms.
And why is, I know that you, well, you know best, I know you do study the coastal, the ecosystems on the coast. What is so important about what you find there?
Well, a couple things. First, when we talk about coastal ecosystems, we're thinking about salt marshes, mangroves, barrier islands, coral reefs, seagrass meadows, all of that structure that's between the ocean and the land where people live. And those ecosystems are really important in two ways with regard to climate change. One, they slow down the energy of the waves as they come in with storms. And so those waves that hit the place where people live have less power, less energy, less destructive power. And the second is that ecosystems like salt marshes absorb a lot of the flooding waters. And so those waters are not flooding streets, they're flooding marshes, which should they would naturally do. And so one of the things that we've learned, we've discovered with our research, is that these ecosystems can do this up to a point. So they can be themselves resilient to sea level rise up to a certain point, but then they can get pushed too far. They can pass a tipping point, and then they can be lost. And so one of the big challenges for scientists as we do our research and inform managers is to understand when, where, and how those tipping points occur so that we can be in a better be better able to sort of project what might happen in the future under different scenarios of sea level rise and storm frequency.
So, Karen, are there any countries or communities that you're following examples of? Is anyone getting this right?
We are, of course.
Of course. Well, we are. But, I mean, are you just picking this out of thin air, you know, out of your own research, or are you building on? Because, you know, I'm thinking about other countries, that, like Cuba.
Yeah.
I heard, I don't know. So...
Well, two things I could say. One is that, I mean, I joke, but I'm quite serious. I mean, at UVA, we are the world leaders in understanding how these shallow coastal systems are protecting coastal communities and understanding these tipping points. And we work with communities on informing how they should manage the systems. We are doing a lot of work in restoration of coastal communities so that we can build that capacity. We work very closely with the Nature Conservancy in that regard, so informing their management. And we also work in the urban areas in Virginia, Hampton Roads, Virginia Beach area. And one of the things that we, there's sort of a paradigm shift. We are no longer just trying to keep the ocean back. We can't do that really anymore. It's that realization that we have to start learning how to live with water that's flooding. So this recurrent flooding is just becoming our new reality. We call it sunny day flooding now. You don't need a storm. You just need a really high tide.
Wow, that's amazing. We're going to go to a hard break, and we'll come right back, I promise, with Karen McGlathery. We're going to talk about the Environmental Resilience Institute a little bit more right after this. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We are every Saturday brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams, our sponsor. We were talking with Fraser Nyman before, Director of Archaeology. You can catch our podcast on 947wpvc.org. And right now, we are lucky enough to have with us Environmental Resilience Institute Director Karen McGlathery. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about partnerships. So I don't know if you want to continue with talking about that a little bit, partnerships in the work that you do.
Sure. Before the break, we talked a little bit about what we were doing at UVA in Virginia, but I also wanted to highlight some of the work that's being done overseas, people that we're working with in the Netherlands and Italy and other regions where they're very low-lying and they're dealing with flooding all the time. As I mentioned, this idea of sunny day flooding, that you don't need to have a storm and storm surge to have flooding. And so there's all sorts of really interesting ways to integrate what we know about natural systems like marshes and what we know about building and design to figure out ways to live with water that's flooding in rather than trying to hold it back, because that's just not working anymore.
And the Environmental Resilience Institute, which I know you just became the head of, and it's new, why did you feel it was necessary to create it at this time?
Right, that's a great question. So historically, a lot of these problems have been addressed within sort of silos, you know, within a school or a discipline. I'm a marine ecologist. I do a lot of work studying plants and sea level rise and storms. But I can't really understand how the system really works now or even in the future unless I understand how people are involved and how what you might do, whether you are damming a river or whether you're plowing your field or whether you're hardening the shoreline with a seawall, that all affects the dynamics of these natural systems. And so the idea behind the Environmental Resilience Institute is that we need multiple points of view in order to find solutions to some of these problems. And so it's not just an engineering problem. It's not just a natural science problem. It's not just a social science problem. But we need all the people at the table, and we need to have them at the table at the very beginning so that we can figure out what our goals are, how we're going to approach this collectively. You know, we all speak different languages in our disciplines, sharing a common language, really collaborating. And so it's that team approach is where I think we're really going to accelerate our ability to make find solutions to some of these really critical problems, like sea level rise and storms, water insecurity, things like that.
I know you're doing research with, with carbon. Can you talk a little, can you educate us about what that's all about?
Okay, so this goes back to the research that we're doing in Virginia. That's really, as I said, a model system globally. And essentially what we've done is the very large restoration of underwater seagrass habitat. And we've worked with colleagues at William & Mary and the Nature Conservancy. They've actually sort of reseeded these areas. They were lost, that seagrasses were extinct because of disease and storms. And we did some research to show that they could actually come back, and they just hadn't because there weren't any seeds for them to recover. And so we did this big restoration program, and one of the things that we've shown from this is that these plants, like other coastal plants, are really good at taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, you know, as they breathe or as they photosynthesize. And a lot of that carbon gets stored in the soil, and it can be stored for centuries or even millennia. Just like you think of a tropical rainforest, we think about that tropical rainforest capturing and storing a lot of carbon. So that carbon capture in coastal areas is something we are just beginning to understand, and it turns out to be really important and one of several strategies for counteracting global warming and the rise of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
How can you tell when climate change is natural and versus human activity?
Right.
How do you determine that?
Yeah, no, that's a really important question. We do it in using multiple lines of evidence. A lot of what we do is look at back at deep time. We have different ways of looking at the changes in the atmosphere, looking at changes in sea level, using cores that we take out of ice or out of the earth, or using the way corals have grown over long periods of time. And so we essentially can reconstruct climate, and so we can look at the rate of change. And from those reconstructions, we can see that the rate of change now is faster than any other time in history. And so it's based on those lines of evidence that we are basing our work on trying to counteract the climate change.
Are you able, with using your field sites and this network of global scientists and researchers, can you use it to inform policymakers or influence what's going on as far as government?
Sure. And that's a big part of what the goals of the Institute is to make our research, what I would say, actionable, so that we can take our research and inform policymakers and decision makers about decisions they could make with regard to energy usage or policies regard to land use in the coastal zone, so we have mechanisms. We're working on mechanisms to translate our research directly to policy. So yeah, that's a huge part of what we're interested in.
And I feel that we have sold it short a little about the whole idea of the Institute. The collaborators that you're reaching out to, and the network you're creating. Who's involved? What are the disciplines you're trying to incorporate into the Institute?
It's very broad. We have people from all the schools at University of Virginia. So we are there are a number of people from architecture and land use planning, environmental sciences, and the humanities, social sciences, politics, economics, business, law, psychology, to name a few.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's a really big effort, and it's I think that's what's so exciting about it. It's the collaboration of these multiple disciplines and also partners outside of the university. And again, I think you need that kind of collaboration if you're going to change the system and change the way things are moving.
What can we do sitting here, lay people? What can people do? I know we can save the really easy things we probably aren't familiar with. We can save water, but are there other things we can do to get involved? Even to go listen to talks, I would love to come hear what you guys are doing in more detail.
Yeah, I mean, there are, we will have public lecture series that people can get involved with. There are a number of nonprofits in the state, in Virginia, nationally, that we partner with that, of course, are working in these same directions. So getting involved with them, supporting them.
What are a couple of those names?
Well, the Nature Conservancy, the Southern Environmental Law Center would be another one. They're located here in town. National Fisheries and Wildlife Federation, that's located in D.C. Mm-hmm. And these are all ones that we share a common goal, and we have different ways of doing it. The Nature Conservancy, for example, uses a lot of volunteers for some of their research projects. Mm-hmm. We use a lot in Virginia on the Eastern Shore, so mm-hmm. that's another way to get involved.
Yeah, that's a great idea, the Nature Conservancy, yeah.
Reduce your carbon footprint.
Yes.
I was just wondering what other, I know you study great detail, the Virginia coast. What other coastlines have you studied, and how are they? How different is that research?
Well, I did my dissertation research in Bermuda, which was a nice place to be, and that in that area where it was similar. There were problems related to water quality, a lot of nutrient pollution in the area. I then went to do research in Denmark. And in Denmark, again, I was focused at that time more on nutrient pollution than I was on climate. But in all these regions, and I have had students that have worked in Africa and Australia, other places in Europe, in all these regions, I think the problems are similar. That's the good thing, that we have this sort of synergism in the way that we are looking at these issues. And so sharing knowledge across different systems helps us come up with more sort of comprehensive guidelines or, you know, ideas for how to manage these systems in a way to make them more resilient.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something.
I was just going to quickly ask you, Karen, in your view, what are the most severe ways that we harm the ecosystem?
You mean any ecosystem?
I Earth? Guess.
That's a big question.
I don't know. I am dumb. However, this answer, you know, enlightens me.
Okay, sure. I mean, I think that we, if you look at the Earth, and the Earth has certain boundaries, you know, there's certain limits to the resources right now that the Earth can provide. So water is one, and overuse of water, you know, and the fact that climate change is affecting water availability for agriculture. So a lot of what's driving it, of course, is at the most fundamental level is the increase in population and the greater demand for resources, and that people are moving to regions that are vulnerable, like the coastline or big cities. And so how we affect the ecosystems is by our use of these resources, and also the carbon dioxide that's released from our energy use, the pollution that goes into our waters from agriculture and from sewage, from waste. That's something that I've spent a lot of time studying. But there are a lot of solutions to these problems. You know, it's not doomsday by any stretch. I mean, they're very serious and they're very critical, but I think we're poised to be able to deal with them in a very aggressive and very positive way.
So do you feel like that's a great optimistic statement? Thank you for making that. Even in light of what's going on with budget cuts, just talk a little bit more about that optimism, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that question. Well, it's challenging right now with what's going on in Washington, for sure, for science. I feel that there's probably a greater majority who believe in the power of knowledge and the power of science and the power of inquiry and evidence. And so based on that, that is my optimism. I think that other sectors may help, at least in the short term, fill some of the gap that the government might be creating. So individuals or foundations. Universities play a huge role in this, and that's what I think is so exciting about having these institutes, or this institute in particular at UVA, is that it's making a statement and bringing people together in a way that we can really accelerate our how we address these problems.
Thank you so much for being here, Karen McGlathery, director of the New Environmental Resilience Institute at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And also thank you to Fraser Nyman again, director of archaeology at Jefferson's Monticello. That was great. Again, 947wpvc.org. You can catch all of our past shows and listen to these great, amazing, once again, amazing people.
I've got one more piece of upbeat news for the palate cleanser.
Okay. What is it?
Very quickly, maybe you've heard of this, but Saudi Arabia's ruling party of one gender has decided that women will be allowed to apply for a license, take driving lessons, and drive any vehicle without needing legal permission from their male guardians, because every other decision does require almost every other decision requires a male guardian, but they will now be able to drive. Exactly.
I mean, that was amazing.
June of 2018. Why it takes this long, I cannot tell you. But
I know that was an amazing. I'm so glad you brought that up. That was an amazing piece of news.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the guardian.
The irony
thing.
Is, at the moment, anyway, that they, for whatever reason, will be able to drive, but they will still need permission to leave their homes alone.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Man.
I know. Among other permissions they
right.
need.
I wonder what they're taking away. They're going to give them that, and they're taking, not to be pessimistic,
yeah.
but no, that's fantastic. And now can they all, like, get in their car and leave the country?
That well, be... exactly. They need a guardian to give them permission to go anywhere. And you know that a son, or well, obviously it's not a daughter, but... If there is no husband around, a woman's guardian may, in fact, be her son, if you can believe it. Of course you can believe it. It's Saudi Arabia. Anyway.
There's so much about that country, and we won't get into it now. Let's get a guest to talk about that, about that country, and what how we're helping support.
And their ecosystem.
What we're buying from them.
I'll make sure to ask them.
Anyway, something for later. Let's just go a little bit over. I was told to go a little bit over. We can talk. We can schmooze for a tiny bit more.
Like about this much more?
About this much more.
Okay, about that much more?
It's
okay.
Such an inside joke, Nancy.
No, it's not.
It's not.
No, not at all.
Okay.
You want to place how many minutes we have?
I don't know, a couple. I want to ask our guests, all right, can you hang out, you guys? They can hang out. Okay. They're going to hang out.
Well, and they might be more interesting than the two of us.
They're definitely more interesting than us, so I might ask them a question or two, but we're going to go to a little station ID, but like, you know, just in a minute, not quite yet.
Oh, okay. So do you want to guess where the GOP is going to have their convention? You want to guess which city is going to actually want them to come in?
Which one?
And wreak havoc, wreak chaos.
Oh, which one?
I don't know.
Oh,
I can't imagine.
It was a real question. Okay.
Well,
There's so much to keep up on. How do you keep up on it?
I'm not keeping up. I'm genuinely flummoxed. I can't. You know, the conventions are coming, and I just can't imagine who's going to want.
All right, let's go to a break, and we'll come right back.
Chaos.
We'll come right back after this break. Okay. How about that?
Okay.
All right. I'm not ready for the break, but almost.
Central Virginia's progressive voice, WPVC LP, Charlottesville.
Do you know the five crucial steps when buying or selling your home? I didn't either until I found the Beckham team at Keller Williams. They helped me buy my first house. Before that, I didn't know a mortgage from a closing. They walked me through the process and took the time to teach me along the way. You can let the Beckham team at Keller Williams help you navigate the real estate market with expertise, integrity, and dedication to your goals. For consultation, questions, or to talk about your goals, it's the Beckham team at Keller Williams, BeckhamTeam.com, or 434-220-2224, and on Facebook. Keller Williams supports 94.7 WPVC.
We're back to the extended version of Apropos of Something. We get longer and longer. We get more and more time every week, Nancy.
Do we deserve it, or
we deserve
something happen at the studio you're not telling me about?
I'm not going to say, but, you know, This is Charlottesville. Lots of things happen here. But just wanted to thank our guests again, Fraser Nyman, Director of Archaeology at Monticello, Karen McGlathery, Environmental Scientist at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, and speaking of things to sign up for, and of course now you're trying to say goodbye, right?
I am. You have like 30 seconds.
Being that I'm not sure how far you are from TJ's Monticello, but I would be interested in going down there if I was closer.
Oh, yeah.
But is it far from where you are?
No.
Without giving your location, of course?
It's not far at all. Everyone knows. Everyone here knows where it is, but it's really close.
Oh,
but will that get you here? Will that get you here? Will that get you to Charlottesville?
Huh?
Will that get you to Charlottesville, coming to Monticello?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Might be. Well, I think you were the reason I was coming down, so you could write me an introduction.
That
I'm coming
not,
all the way back.
That has not worked to get you here.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to sign out now. We're going to go on to our next show, but thank you, everyone, for being here. Thanks for Keller Williams, the Beckham team there, for supporting our show each and every week. We're going to have a great show for you in the coming weeks. Thanks, Nance.
Yep, thank you, Ellen.